What's up, everybody? Welcome to a Renew.org features audio post. This is Dave Stovall. The following is an interview between Daniel McCoy, Renew.org's editorial director, and Mark Moore, teaching pastor at Christ Church of the Valley in the Phoenix area. We made this audio post available on July 15th, which is the day before Mark's new book, Core 52, is available for purchase. Mark will be presenting at our 2019 Renew Gathering, November 6th in Nashville, so make sure you save that date. He'll have his book, Core 52, available there as well. So I hope you guys enjoy listening to this interview. Let's dive in.
Okay, I'm here with Mark Moore. Mark Moore is teaching pastor at Christ Church of the Valley in Peoria, Arizona. Before that, Mark was professor at Ozark Christian College for over 20 years. He's the author of numerous books, including the very recent release, Core 52. Mark, thanks so much for being on with me.
That's my honor. Thank you.
So, Mark, you strike me as someone who is very, very disciplined, disciplined in your research, your writing projects, public speaking, even fitness, weight training. What are some rhythms that you have built into your schedule to help you to be so disciplined? For example, I go to bed at, whatever time.
Yeah, for me, the secret has been you can only be disciplined in a very limited number of areas. And so it's an issue of prioritizing those areas. So for me, Bible study is my priority, and part of that's my natural love of Bible study. So I'm going to have always a lion's share of my career building hours in scripture research. But the other things that you mentioned, like sleep and exercise, by the way, diet, I'm terrible in. Like, I have zero self-control, so I have to be self-controlled in exercise, to counterbalance that. But if I were to prioritize probably my disciplines, honestly, is Bible study, then second is sleep. I'm an eight-hour guy night. I get a lot done, but I can't do it without my rest. And the third would be physical exercise. And again, because you can't run in fifth gear as long as I need to without having good physical exercise. So I don't know that I'm that disciplined I wouldn't say it's disciplined as much as it's having the priorities to accomplish my goals.
So 8 hours a night, how do you do that?
Yeah, well, I'm an empty nester. The trick of being an empty nester is to procreate very young. I was 21, so it was like, in my mid-40s, I'm an empty nester. So that worked out. Not by any design of mine. It just happened that way. So, but even when my kids were young, I would, I was a late night person. My wife was an early morning person, so we compromised, and now I go to bed early and sleep late. So typically I'm in bed by 9:30, might read for a little bit, and then I'm up at 5:30 or 6.
Very cool. So content creation, creative communication, those seem to really fill your bucket, but you can't do only that all the time. Have there been times when you've said, in order for this to be sustainable, I'm going to have some fill in the blank in my life? I mean, what for you keeps all of that output sustainable?
That's an excellent question, Daniel. And so if as soon as you were asking the question, what I thought of is content creation is ridiculously quick for me, to the point that twice in my life, I shouldn't even admit this, twice in my life, I woke up with a finished sermon outline. It's stupid. Like, yeah. I don't understand it. But what I do know about myself is during my teaching career, I could produce nothing the last 2 weeks of May. We had just finished finals. I was exhausted, emotionally tapped out. And so what I learned was that the creative process happens when you have margins. And I stole this somewhere. I don't even remember what, but it's probably the book Margins. But you take a piece of paper and you write at the top, bottom, right, and left side, time, money, energy, spirituality. and you fold the paper to represent the amount of margin that you have. If your margin is thin or non-existent in any of those areas of time, money, physical energy, or spirituality, then you are going to cripple your creative process. And I think everybody has their own creative energies, their own space in which they excel. It could be a physician, it could be a writer, it could be a coach. When you have no margin, some people say, I'm not creative. I would guess that it's not the creative process that's lacking, because that's a part of your imago Dei, right? Mm-hmm. It's the margin, because creativity doesn't happen in the main part of the page, it happens in the margins.
That's good. So is there a category for people like you with one foot solidly in the world of academia, another foot solidly in church ministry? Would churchman scholar be a good description, or is there a better description for that?
Boy, I hadn't even thought about what kind of label I would put on myself. And it's kind of funny. I'm always, struggle would be the wrong word. Balance would be the wrong word. It's somewhere between those. When I'm in the church world, I'm always wanting to go deeper than people want. When I'm in the academic world, I'm always wanting to be more practical than people are sometimes comfortable with. So for me, it's not like, you say it like it's a compliment, but there really is it's almost a no man's land. And I don't mean to make myself sound like some genius savant. I'm not. And I'm certainly not alone. My friend Mark Driscoll just moved to the Valley, and he is certainly in that same category. Just read a book over the weekend on Gen Z. And there's a pastor in this Mecklenburg church in North Carolina. That's not Mecklenburg. It's they call it the Mech. He is another one, scholar, pastor, but they're all around. So I'm not particularly unique in that. But those of us that kind of live in that no man's land, people on the outside might look and say, wow, I wish I could live there. But there is a discomfort in always feeling a little out of place where you are. And if you can own that, then you can actually be a benefit to bridge both sides of the conversation. Because let's face it, so many mega churches say we don't need the Bible college, and the Bible college saying we don't need the mega church. And the fact is we need each other.
Mm-hmm. Are there any really unique challenges in addition to kind of feeling a bit out of place at times, any additional challenges of participating in both worlds at the same time? So the world of scholarship, the world of church ministry, are there any guardrails that need to be up to make that effective?
Yeah, I don't know about guardrails. I know that I am naturally an introvert, which makes me better at my scholarship, but I love people. And so just think of a book on one table and then a person sitting on the other side of the table. You have to make a choice, because you can't be with both at the same time. So there does need to be a balance of how you manage. Scholarship takes time, like hours and hours and hours upon weeks, months, years, and decades. So in order to get to that, you do need to pull away from people, but that's people are the end users. So for me, trying to find that balance is the tightrope balance. And it's no different than what anybody else has. Daniel, you've got a wife and kids. And so balancing time with your wife, which is priority, and balancing time with your kids, which is priority, is that same kind of dance of trying to be true to your perpetual quest for the deep things of God, but then coming out of the cave long enough and translating the depth of what you found, get the cookies down to the bottom shelf so everyone has access. And I don't think I'm the best scholar. Well, I know I'm not. And I know I'm not the best preacher. But I hope to be a unique combination of the two that allows some, not all, to appreciate a deeper perspective on Scripture.
In your pursuit of that goal, have there been things that you can look back and say, yeah, I really had to let that go in order to really prioritize, this more important goal? Have there been any kind of painful goodbyes to anything that you've had to have along the way?
This is, yes, and this might surprise you, but one of the things that I loved in my teaching career was the non-biblical ancient literature. So the Talmud, the Mishnah, the Dead Sea Scrolls. I cannot keep pursuing the ancient Greco-Roman literature, at least not to the extent that I did when I was at Ozark, because I start talking about Philo or, you name an ancient author, and nobody cares. And so what I found really set me apart at the university, I mean, it really gave me a voice and a persona, now just separates me from people. So that I've had to give up on, although we are a church that writes a lot of our own music. And one project that I want to start working on and actually have started working on is a set of worship songs that are from the Dead Sea Scrolls that no one has sung for 2,000 years. So that could be a fun project and maybe a way of scratching that itch for me.
Yeah, very cool. So you came out of the, you're still at Ozark in the sense of online professor, but that transition from full-time professor to pastor, what was something that was hard about that transition for you?
You know, I don't mean to sound stupid, but it wasn't hard for me because my entire time at Ozark, I was always preaching in the local church and often doing interim ministries in the local church. So that the actual workload is just leaning a little more to the right instead of the left. What was hard, and this actually stunned me, is that when you are a Bible college professor, and don't take this the wrong way, self-promotion is an advantage to the institution. So the more I spoke in churches, the more I was at camps, the more I wrote, the more students would have access to information about Ozark. And so that was a point of actually a commendation from the institution. When you're in the local church, unless you're the senior pastor, that kind of external-oriented ministry, helping the Big C Church, preaching at other places, writing more books, is not an advantage to the local church. And so what got me praise in my previous position suddenly was a negative, and it took me a couple of years to realize, oh, so that's why there's a little bit of disconnect.
Yeah, that makes sense. What has been something that's been very rewarding about that transition?
The greatest reward in ministry is seeing life change in people. So yesterday I spoke at a church in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm getting on the plane to come home, and a young dude, it would be like the envy of every dude. He was physically fit, bright eyes, highly intelligent, successful in his job. He came up to me in the airport. He was actually on the same flight and said, "Hey, I just want you to know that the message you preached today really hit home for me and my wife," because I told two stories of friends of mine that had affairs, and he was just totally honest. "I had an affair a year and a half ago, and my wife had her issues, and we're sitting there in church looking at each other and going, well, maybe we can make it." I get that maybe half a dozen times a week, which sounds extraordinary, and it actually is extraordinary, and it never gets old hearing that something you said from stage or the way you carried yourself in a public space made such a difference that a marriage is saved, a child is reunited with a parent, an addiction is broken. That's pretty gratifying.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you get to travel a lot. You have gotten to travel to a lot of the Bible lands. Could you tell us what's the most meaningful Bible lands moment that you've had?
Well, they're all, anytime anyone gets a chance to step on ground that Jesus or the Apostle Paul had stepped on, that's just a wonderful gift from God. Over the last 3 years, I have led a hike in Israel, 110 miles in 10 days, with men only, no checked luggage. That is a thrill. And I tell the guys that God is going to speak to you. You don't know when, you don't know where. But if we're needing to move on, you have to move on unless God's speaking to you. And then just raise your hand. You're having a moment. And we'll all know. We'll leave you alone. We'll wait. I had a moment in Cana of Galilee. I'd never been to Cana before because bus tours, it's really difficult to get to the church. So I'd never been there. We go to this church and there's signs all over the walls that say, don't write on the walls. You go down into the below the church, and it's an archaeological site of an ancient first century home, which is pretty unique because Cana is a very small town. They have a very long memory, and this church is very old. And as I'm standing there looking down into the archaeological site, realizing the likelihood of authenticity of this site is in the 90s. Because there's not a lot of rich people in Cana. And the rich people knew where they lived, even long after the house fell down. They knew that was the spot. And then they would build over it. So it struck me, this is in all likelihood the place where Jesus turned water into wine and the place where Jesus healed the nobleman's son from Capernaum. As I'm staring down into the stones, if you've ever been in a hotel room and you hear someone on the other side of the wall, you can't understand the words, but you hear the tone. All I can tell you is that's what I heard. Not through my ears, but there was a like a wrinkle in time, and I felt the pleading of a father asking Jesus to heal his son. And I'm stunned. I can't speak. So we leave the site, and as you might imagine, the guys are always asking me questions about every site we go to. And so it's really a 5-hour Q&A when you're hiking. I couldn't speak. And I just kept raising my hand to these guys. Not now. About 30 minutes later, I went to my best friend who was on the trip, and I said, man, something happened to me back there. He said, I know. And he pulled out his iPhone. He recognized the moment and actually captured it on a picture on his iPhone. So to me, that was a pretty substantial moment for me.
That's beautiful. Who are a couple of thinkers who, whatever they write, you'll read it? They're just that good, that helpful.
N.T. Wright is one. Another, and he's not super well known, but he is a pastor theologian. His name is Greg Boyd, and he is an evangelical, but he's also in the elite echelon of biblical scholars. I don't know how he pulls that off, but he's got a great, we've talked on the phone a little bit. He's got a great team around him. So all he does is study and preach, teach in the university. But he's another one. Greg Boyd is a name that I trust quite a bit. And then I would say from a preaching standpoint, I know some are going to have trouble with some of his theology, but as a communicator making the church accessible, I think Andy Stanley, Craig Groeschel they're just at the top of the game. And even if you disagree with their theology in one point or two, the way they apply deep scholarship to practical ministry is pretty commendable.
So your new book is Core 52. And 52 chapters going through the 52 most important verses in the Bible. My guess is that selecting the 52 was at times a difficult process.
It started as the top 100, and I thought, you know, title of a book, the top 100, that would really sell well. And the publisher said, nope, we want 52. And they had a vision for one a week for a year, which turns out to be super helpful in the local church. So I'll tell you, just between you, me, and the fence post, and everybody listening, that I cheated. Because though there are 52 core verses, each week has three more verses to meditate on. Each of those three verses are in the same trajectory. So part of the strategy is to show how that key verse ricochets through the entire Bible as a trajectory. Mm. So in total, there's 208. Now, of all the thousands and thousands, that's still very, very slim. But one of the things I noticed, and this is real ministry, and this, you know, talking about me transitioning from the academic world into the preaching world. In the academic world, the more the merrier. The more scriptures I throw at you, the better the class. The thicker the curriculum, the longer the papers, the more you get out of it. That is not true in the local church. And I just had breakfast with a guy who is in the demolition business. He is very well respected in all of Phoenix. He makes really, really good money, and he's super generous with it. He doesn't have a lot of time. So I have to think of my friend who is at the top of his game. How can I give him executive level training in the Bible so that he gets the most from the minimum amount of time that he can put into it? That's the reality. So we've created a product, and I know theologians are going to object to 52. Oh, there's got to be, you know, you didn't have this one in, you didn't have that. That's okay. I'm not writing for theologians. I'm writing for real people with real responsibilities in their lives that they're going to do the best they can with the limited amount of white space on the margin of the paper that they have. That's the purpose of Core 52.
Very cool. So you brought it down to 52, and out of the 52, is there one chapter that is dearest to your heart?
Depends on the day. And I hope that's like a helpful answer, because there's one of the chapters that I love, love, love is on Psalm 1, on happiness. Because if you look at the science of happiness, the chemicals of your brain, serotonin, oxytocin, dopamine, what triggers those happy juices in your brain are significance, discovery, and relationships. Well, guess what you find in Psalm 1, 1 through 3? Significance, discovery, and relationships. And so the way science matches the psychology of the Bible is, I think, absolutely extraordinary. But then on another day, if I'm in an apologetic mood, I'm going to talk about the resurrection, 1 Corinthians 15, and the solid historical foundation upon which our lives theologically stand. But then on another day, it's creation. Because the entire Trinity shows up in Genesis 1, 1, 2, and 3. And I just think, how did God do that? In the first three verses of the Bible, he set the trajectory for our relationships with him. It's breathtaking. Or on another day, it could be Revelation 21, talking about heaven and the new Jerusalem and the new earth that we'll live on in new bodies. So those are four that, off the top of my head today, I would probably lean into.
Very cool. So tell me about the unique cultural moment that we're at right now, kind of what you see there, and then how Core 52 helps with that, helps intersect with that.
I do think that we are overwhelmed by the divisiveness of our political system right now. And I don't see that actually as a Republican, Democrat, or left-right debate. I actually see it as a consequence of the technology. It is a brand new experiment that we don't know the consequence of yet, and we call it the smartphone. And the ramifications of that are, because of the smartphone, we have instant access to every kind of information. But that's too much for us to actually bear. So what we've done is, from Facebook to Twitter to Google, every technology of information, everyone is filtering and creating a unique to you, following your interest and search history. That will determine what news you get, what products you see, and what relationships you have. Well, you can see the problem. Those that want liberal left information are going to get liberal left information. Those that want fundamentalist right information are going to get that. And so it feels like everybody who is informed agrees with you, and then you run into someone who doesn't agree with you, and you think, well, you're just crazy. And that's why it's so easy for the left and right to disdain one another. And that's an important word, Daniel, because a marriage counselor is not particularly thrown off by anger. A couple comes in, they're mad at each other. That indicates they still care. But when you move from anger to disgust, your marriage is over. So we are at a cultural crisis that I think is irrecoverable unless there is a common core of wisdom that we can both tap into. This nation, some will love this, some will hate it, but no one can argue with it. Our nation was founded on biblical principles. If we don't get back to a common core, we will always be a nation divided. And so as we have moved morally away from a biblical foundation, we've also moved literarily, culturally, philosophically away from the biblical foundation. Core 52 is a tool that will give us a common language, even in the church, to discuss what is a biblical worldview. If we don't recapture that, I think we are going to see a return to the Roman Empire.
And could you unpack that for us as far as the Roman Empire? What do you see us kind of returning to as the biblical foundation gets unraveled?
That's a good question. If you don't have a biblical foundation, then you don't have any commonality for morality. And if you don't have any commonality for morality, you have no commonality for law. And if you don't have any commonality for law, then you can't have a culture or society in which families can grow up in security. So when I talk about going back to the Roman Empire, it's a pre-Christian Roman Empire where every different household had their own family god, and even religion itself was more about political or social power than it was about morality. We are not a less religious culture. In fact, Gen Z is more spiritually oriented than Gen X or millennials. And if you can actually see this in our television programming, there's a whole lot of talk about goats and the occult, the spirit world. There are actually more Gen Zs that believe in spirits than believe in God. It's crazy. There are more people who pray than believe in God, which it's crazy. Who are you praying to? So we could become a very religious or spiritual culture without knowing the ethics that God gave us in the Ten Commandments, that honestly, that's the foundation of every advanced modern society, is based upon the law that orbits around the Ten Commandments. If we lose God, then we're going to lose morality. You lose morality, you lose law. You lose law, you lose society.
And would you say you lose truth and it all becomes power?
Of course. Without God, there is no truth. And without truth, then you start to praise the activity of Hitler, who carried out his philosophy of Darwinian evolution correctly. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds crazy to even put it like that, but when you look at the historical trajectory, it really does bear the weight of that statement.
So you have had the opportunity of working at some great institutions. I mean, Ozark, CCV, your many years as a professor at Ozark, what is one thing that you wish other Christian colleges would learn from Ozark?
Well, I think when you work at great institutions, one of the prayers that our founder prayed, Seth Wilson, is that Ozark would be the best institution it could be, and that every other institution would be better. And when you have that kind of generous heart, that's part of what makes for a great institution. So I think about Johnson is another Christian college I think very, very highly of. In our neck of the woods, Grand Canyon University is doing some pretty unique and powerful things. There's always room to grow in every institution, but if getting back to your question, what do I wish that other institutions would do that Ozark has done? There's a danger in this, but Ozark graduates have a deep loyalty not only to the institution, but also to those who graduated from that institution. The consequence of that is, if you look at the largest Restoration Movement churches in America, a large percentage of them are led by Ozark graduates, because Ozark graduates, not all, obviously, but they tend to pass along the successful narratives of their own circle. And sometimes the difference between success and failure is it's a thin line. And if you get the support, the love, the affirmation, the insight that you can from your fellows, it pushes you across the finish line. So I would hope that for every institution that has a biblical foundation.
And now, as teaching minister at Christ Church of the Valley in the Phoenix area, what's one thing you wish that other churches would learn from CCV?
What do I wish other churches would learn from CCV? Let me just tick off a few. And again, there's other great churches in the area. We're very, very proud to be partners and friends with them. But one of the distinguishing marks of our church is that we unapologetically reach men. And in a Me Too movement culture, that sounds chauvinistic. It actually is incredibly liberating for women when their husbands are spiritually in tune with the church. And I could tell you story after story of couples, marriages, families that they just have a different trajectory. And like it or not, men are still the decision makers for activities of the family on the weekend. And that's one thing. A second thing is I wish that people would learn that fellowship should be architected, not programmed. We try to program fellowship dinners and fellowship nights and sing-alongs or whatever we're trying to do, but fellowship is innate. We are created as gregarious creatures. If you give people a warm and safe place to hang out, they will come. I think Starbucks proved that by selling bad coffee in a good environment, and it went crazy. Environment, environment, environment. Mm-hmm. A third thing that I don't know if we could even pull this off, but CCV is a place where if I have a Christian who is causing problems in the church, they are not going to be prioritized. It is the lost who are prioritized. I mean, literally, when I finish preaching, I make a beeline and I have people help me get through the crowds so that I can get to our first-time guest. Those who are not part of the church get priority over those who are. Because if a Christian gets upset, they will find another church. If a lost person gets upset, or if they're ignored, or if they leave, they go to hell. So we talk a lot about prioritizing the lost and evangelism, but until you're ready to lose members so that you can open the front door to lost people, it's going to be really difficult to live that priority out.
That's very helpful. Let's talk about legacy. We're all going to die someday. If you could boil it down to two or three statements, what truths do you really, really want to leave behind?
As you're asking the question, I'm thinking about people, and then you went to truths. I don't know that I want to leave any truths behind. The Bible is all we need to leave. But people, I want to leave people behind. And let me just say two things. I love that question. Let me say two things. There came a point in my career that I got more pleasure out of my student success than my own. And right now, I love to preach. It is an honor every time I stand on stage. But I actually get more joy and satisfaction of watching one of my students or disciples preach than when I preach. And until a man or woman gets more joy out of another success, then the whole talk of legacy is empty words. That's the first thing. The second statement that I would make, and this goes back to when I was traveling very heavily. I was very aggressive building my career. I was taking speaking engagements, you know, trying to keep up with Mark Scott, J.K. Jones, and, you know, other demigods are just, I mean, that's just difficult. And I was on that trajectory. And I don't mean to be paint them in a picture. This is about me, not them. But I recognized on a Father's Day, my kids gave me a card that said, "The world's best dad." And I knew I wasn't. In fact, I would have given myself a C+ at best. But then I realized, to them, I'm the only dad in the world. Therefore, I am the world's best dad to two people. And it struck me that to get a bigger audience, I had to travel farther from the only thing I would ever be best at. And I would just warn young, aggressive men and women building their careers that your legacy, your biggest legacy, is in the smallest package. And if you're not great in your immediate circle, it doesn't matter how great you are in the broader world. The fact is, when Billy Graham died, everyone said, you know, who's going to be the next Billy Graham? Why do we need one? Why would we need another Billy Graham? We've got great local churches. And I would say this about CCV. We average 35,000 on a weekend. That's our trend so far this year. We don't need another CCV. We need 1,000 churches that live authentically in their thin circle. God is the master of the minute. He doesn't need big. He certainly doesn't need me to be big. So that's all I would say about legacy. I'm too young to even have a legacy.
Yeah. Well, that is helpful thoughts. I very much appreciate that. What are a couple of conversations in heaven that you're just really looking forward to having? And I'm not trying to suggest that you're getting closer to that, but you know, what are a couple conversations?
With Jesus, I think I need to ask him, why me? I'm not special. I'm not particularly more faithful than anyone else. Why me? Why did he choose me? For the wife I have, for the kids I have, for the job I have, why me? I don't deserve it. It's that, and I'm not trying to be falsely humble there. You know me well enough to know there's very little false humility in me. But I just, that's one that's going to blow me away. There's some people that I want to say thank you to. Probably, you know, Augustine, for being a pastor scholar. That's been he really set the stage for that. Origen maybe have been another one that set the stage for that. But there's some people that are pastor scholars that I just want to say thank you to. There are some other people behind the scenes that I would love to say thank you to. And there's actually a book written called Gospel Patrons about several of the major movements in modern church history where those that were in the limelight had someone in the shadows that were funding and cheerleading them. Mm. And I really rather meet like Moses. Okay, we'll have a conversation. This is great, but I would really rather know who it was that sacrificed without the fanfare to push the gospel forward.
Thanks again for listening, and don't forget to come listen to Mark at the Renew Gathering November 6th in the Nashville area. He'll be speaking from our main stage, and we'll have Core 52 available. See you guys there.